particularly for England and Wales, which will be wet and windy with gales across the south coast. The northern half of the country will be windy with sunshine and showers.
Many thanks, Star. Now, there has to be some compensation for Monday being the first working day of the week, and there is. We've got a new book of the week. As the National Theatre celebrates its 50th anniversary, Philip Ziegler has written a new biography of one of our greatest ever actors, Laurence Olivier. Toby Jones is the reader.
In the London Theatre, in the late spring of 1907, the dramatic big guns were conspicuously silent. No play by Shaw, no Ibsen, no Chekhov. Even the Mikado had been banned by the Lord Chamberlain, who feared it might offend the visiting Japanese Crown Prince. Among the leading actors and actresses, Irving had died 2 years before, Ellen Terry was in New York, and Viola Tree in Germany. But it was not just the paucity of great plays and players which menaced the London scene. There was a more ominous threat. By 1907, Chaplin had already made his first silent film. D.W. Griffith had started work in Hollywood. Several London theatres were interspersing plays with films. Even the Old Vic showed every Saturday night moving landscapes and seascapes to enraptured audiences. The first theatre entirely devoted to films, the Balham Empire, opened in the summer of 1907. Many more were planned. Could the theatre resist this competition? Some thought not. Laurence Kerr Olivier was born on the 22nd of May, 1907. There was nothing in his ancestry that would suggest he would take to the stage. His father, Gerard, was a prep school master who opened his own school, failed to make a success of it, then switched course, and in 1904 was ordained and became curate at St. Martin's, Dorking. Some years before, he had married Agnes Crookenden, who had hoped for a life of modest comfort as a schoolmaster's wife, and instead found herself living in penury on the stipend of an Anglican priest. While her husband was strident and bad-tempered, Agnes was quiet, resolute, and long-suffering. She settled down to give her family as comfortable and secure a life as possible. Her eldest daughter, Sybil, was born in 1901, and a son, christened Gerard but always known as Dickie, followed in 1904. Arriving 3 years later, Laurence was unplanned, and by his father at least, unwanted. Gerard considered Laurence a bothersome addition to the family. There was something about the child's stolidity and baby plumpness that drove him almost to a frenzy, Sybil remembered. Baby or not, he bores me and I've had enough. Laurence, nicknamed Paddy due to his explosive temper, does not seem to have been a prepossessing child. According to a family friend, he learnt deliberately to provoke his father's wrath in order to produce more love and attention from his mother. He felt an urgent need to ingratiate himself with all around him. Everyone likes to be liked, but Olivier's craving for popularity was both exaggerated and enduring. He's coy. He's vain. He has tantrums. He needs to be wooed, said his friend and admirer, Elia Kazan, many years later. The temper that earned him his nickname stayed with him all his life. His explosions were all the more terrifying for being unpredictable. Once, dining with the actor Laurence Harvey, Harvey ridiculed in turn Ralph Richardson, John Gielgud, and Paul Scofield. Olivier erupted. How dare you! Call yourself an actor! You're not even a bad, bad actor! You can't act at all, you stupid, hopeless, snivelling little arsehole! He then stormed out. But true to his character, the next day he repented and sent Harvey a bouquet of 24 red roses. There were other, more estimable traits that were evident in his infancy. If he started on some enterprise, he would not stop, plugging away at a childish puzzle till he had solved it. Nothing would deter him throughout his life. "He was the most disciplined man I've ever met," said the director Franco Zeffirelli. "It is the first secret of his success. Steel discipline, and merciless with himself and others. No excuses, no weaknesses." At the age of 9, in 1916, he was admitted to the All Saints Choir School. It was soon evident he was not going to shine as a scholar. Handwriting poor, spelling careless, composition slovenly, arithmetic disgraceful, was the harsh judgment at the end of one of his early terms. Things improved, but not to any great extent. Where he did fit in was in the choir. "He has a fine voice and much ability," was the verdict. But the choir school made a more significant contribution to his future. The vicar of All Saints was an energetic theatre-goer and had recruited as a master an amateur actor of some distinction. The result was that All Saints enjoyed a reputation for acting far beyond that of most comparable schools. Olivier was identified as being a boy with both potential as an actor and an eagerness to perform, and he responded to this encouragement with rapturous enthusiasm. In his second year, at age 12, he was cast as Brutus in a production of Julius Caesar. As usual, the school had drawn a distinguished audience. The Duke of Newcastle, a benefactor of All Saints, presented Olivier with a copy of the play taken from his own library and inscribed as a souvenir of the splendid performance. Most striking of all, the leading actress of the age, Ellen Terry, came to see the show and noted in her diary that the boy who had played Brutus was already a great actor. In 1920, after a brief illness, Agnes Olivier died. For any 12-year-old, the death of a mother must be a fearful blow. For Olivier, remote from his father, it seemed his world had been obliterated. "I've been looking for her ever since," he remembered many years later. "I can't think I've ever loved anybody quite as much. My mother was my life, really." He was sustained by the support of his brother and sister. They stood by him and restored to him some sense of intimacy and belonging. Sybil, in particular, assumed many of the responsibilities of a mother. Agnes Olivier's last words had been, "Be kind to Larry." Her husband paid them scant attention, but Sybil took them to heart. He moved on to St. Edward's, Oxford, where he learnt the value and satisfaction of hard work. He buckled down. He was not notably clever, but he had an extraordinarily retentive memory, quite valuable for a schoolboy faced with exams. He held his own. He was chosen for the school play, A Midsummer Night's Dream, cast as Puck. He flung himself into the role, and in a way that was going to become maddeningly familiar to fellow performers over the next 60 years, attracted far greater attention than his part would have been expected to command. At 17, it was time to decide the pattern of his future life. Up till then, he had assumed, without thinking much about it, that he would follow his father into the church. Now he concluded that he did not have a sufficiently strong belief to take the plunge. He contemplated following his brother, who was making a life in India. One evening, the matter came up with his father, and he mentioned going abroad. "Don't be such a fool," said his father. "You're going on the stage." "Am I?" stammered Olivier. "Well, of course you are." Olivier was to go on to the Central School of Speech Training and Dramatic Art, where he won a scholarship. Peggy Ashcroft joined in the same term. One teacher there was said to have written to Olivier's father, urging him to withdraw his son. "He's no good. He looks like a farm boy." His appearance did verge on the uncouth. His hair grew down his brow, and he had buck teeth. The head of the school disconcerted him by putting the tip of her finger at the base of his hairline and running it down to the top of his nose. "You have a weakness here," she pronounced. Olivier attributes his passion for disguise to this. For many years he was ill at ease with his appearance, and sought to conceal it with false noses and other such devices. Uncouth or not, his talent was obvious. Together with Peggy Ashcroft, he graduated with the gold medal for Best Actor of the Year. It was a satisfactory end to his education. Now it remained for him to put that education to good use. His ambitions were boundless. "Don't you realize," he blurted out to a friend, "I want to be the greatest actor in the world." As a starting point, he won a place in the Birmingham Rep, as did Peggy Ashcroft and Ralph Richardson, whom Olivier thought ponderous and smug at first. But over time, they became the closest of friends. The 2 years that he spent at the Rep changed the whole course of his career and his physical appearance. He'd gone there as a gangling young man. Now his hair was refashioned, and at some expense and a lot of pain, the teeth were fixed. By the time he left, he had been groomed into glossy splendour, recreating his body as well, running and dieting, and acquiring muscular arms and legs. In the first year there, he appeared in 15 plays, a grueling but enormously valuable experience. In 1928, the company moved for a season to the Royal Court in London. The next few months established Olivier as an important player on the London stage. "Most people from the Rep took advantage of being in London to have a good time," wrote the director. "Not Larry. While other players were out carousing, he would be back in the empty dressing room, reading aloud from this or that play." Olivier was not immune to the temptations of the flesh. From childhood, he had been prone to fall in love. "Claire is so pretty, Mummy," he would say, or, "I love Sarah. She has such sweet little teeth." With adolescence, he hungered for sex, but for religious reasons felt his lust should not be indulged except in marriage. The result was a determination to get married before he was ready to do so. Peggy Ashcroft claimed that he was on the point of proposing to her when a lavatory flushing in the next room made it seem inappropriate. The opportunity did not come up again. Then he found himself playing opposite Jill Esmond, an actress a few months younger than him, but better established in the theatre. Her family had theatrical connections, and her mother decided that Olivier had a bright future and would make an excellent husband for their daughter. Olivier was not madly in love, but he was quite ready to tell himself he was. As he wrote in his autobiography, "Though not dazzlingly attractive, she would most certainly do excellently well for a wife." Jill took a role in New York, and he was offered a chance to pursue her there. The play in which he was to appear, a thriller called Murder on the Second Floor, proved a failure, but he enjoyed himself extravagantly, loved the buzz and excitement of New York life, and persuaded Jill Esmond to agree to an engagement while they were there. The marriage did not last, but the affection for New York, indeed for the United States, never faltered. The marriage was fixed for the 25th of July, 1930. A month beforehand, his career took a momentous turn. He was, of course, well acquainted with the work of Noel Coward, had admired him from afar, but had not worked with him. Then, on June the 18th, he was summoned to the presence. A new life began.
Toby Jones was reading extracts from Olivier by Philip Ziegler. The book is abridged and directed by Eileen Horn, produced by Clive Brill, and is a Pacificus production for BBC Radio 4. The shipping forecast awaits us right after Sailing By. sailing by, and so to the shipping forecast issued by the Met Office on behalf of the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency at midnight 15 on Tuesday the 5th of November. There are warnings of gales in Thames, Dover, White, Portland, Plymouth, Biscay, Fitzroy, Sole, Lundy, Fastnet, Irish Sea, Rockall, Bailey and South East Iceland. The general synopsis at 1800. Deepening Atlantic low moving slowly eastwards, expected 300 miles west of Bailey 967 by 1800 Tuesday. New low expected German Bight 985 by the same time. The area forecasts for the next 24 hours. Viking, north at Sierra, south at Sierra, northeast 40s. Northwesterly 5 to 7, backing southerly 4 or 5 later. Showers, rain later in Viking and northeast 40s, good, occasionally moderate. Southwest 40s, Cromarty, Forth, Tyne, Dogger. Northwesterly, backing southwesterly 4 or 5, veering westerly 5 to 7 later. Rain or showers, good, occasionally moderate. Fisher, German Bar.